The South Dakota State Legislature rolls into its final week from SDPB. Today is Wednesday, March 5th. This is In the Moment State House. Coming up this hour, SDPB's politics and public policy reporter Lee Strubinger is with us for an update on the property tax debate in Pierre. We also have CJ Keene. He will give us insight into the latest debate about who can use which bathrooms in the state. Also joining us this hour, Attorney General Marty Jackley will hear the latest from the South Dakota Crime Report, and we'll talk about his transparency in his spending vouchers with South Dakota state money. We've also got Will Mortensen joining us. We'll talk about economic development in the state and what it means to trust your constituents. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDN Communications Studio in the Capitol Building of here. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. Welcome to In the Moment State House on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh, and we are broadcasting today from the SDN Communications Studio in the Capitol Building in Pierce. Seated across the table from me, our politics and public policy reporter, Lee Strubinger. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
All right. Tell me some of the things that you're following this week, Lee.
This week in particular, I'm really following three kind of property tax relief related bills that are still out there, or at least I hope there are three. but there are three that lawmakers are really kind of talking about. And they each kind of signify what kind of position or priority that particular chamber has. So you got a House bill that the House is really pushing, Senate's pushing another bill. And then you also have a governor's bill that also looks to bring some kind of relief as well. And so those are all kind of in the mix here towards the end of session.
So it's not too long ago when they did the sales tax sunset conversation. Property tax was discussed then. They did not make decisions on property tax. Mm-hmm. How is this conversation about property tax different than the conversation, was it 2 years ago?
Well,
last year?
Yeah, it was a couple years ago.
One
of the things that is really different is, you know, even go back to the Blue Ribbon Task Force, which was when the state bumped the sales tax from 4 to 4.5, that 5% went to increasing teacher pay, but it also went to property tax relief. And so a couple years ago when they rolled the sales tax back a little bit from 4.5 to 4.2, you know, that is going to affect the amount of property tax relief and money going to education and kind of the kind of budget scenario that we're currently in. So, yes, property taxes have been discussed for a couple years now. A few years ago, they went with sales tax as opposed to property tax relief. Now we're talking about property tax relief.
Can you explain to me the difference between the three proposals on the table?
I will do my best.
Okay, thank you.
We'll start with what the Senate has sent over to the House, which is basically what opponents are calling as basically California's property tax, Prop 13 scenario. We basically roll back assessments to their November of 2020 level, and then it would increase them by no more than 3% going forward. And so that would kind of set your property tax level for the next property tax year and so forth. When there's a change in ownership, that assessment will get reevaluated and then increase 3% from there. There's concern among critics about that proposal for a number of reasons. One, it came out of the Senate very strong. It passed unanimously. It creates what a lot of people think are separate taxing districts or separate taxing levels for what could be similar properties. You could have nearly identical houses. If one sells at a different time, those property taxes are going to go up while another is raising at from a lower rate. And there is concern that particular bill is not constitutional. It actually says in our state constitution that each particular class of taxing district has to be taxed at essentially the same rate. They say this would alter that, but it does have a lot of steam heading out of the Senate and over to the House. What the House is concerned about is the taxing districts that collect property taxes and their spending. So you've got education, you've got counties, and you've got municipalities. And so they're reducing the maximum amount that these taxing districts can ask for in terms of the rate that it's currently set at 2, it would bring it down to 2.5. those taxing districts.
It's currently set at 2 and bring it down to 2.5?
It's currently at a maximum of 3 or inflation, whichever is less.
Oh, I see.
This would bring it down to 2.5.
Okay.
And so what that would do is it would require those taxing districts to really kind of opt out. So it would be more of a public-facing kind of way for a school district or a taxing district or a county to be like, hey, we got to opt out of this and increase the rate because we got to fix potholes or we need to repair a roof. And so proponents of that in the House say that would lead to a more transparent process in terms of what those taxing districts are doing.
Interesting.
And then the governor's bill does a lot of different things. But the concern from both sides on that is that it caps growth, like the growth amount, at 2%, which would really affect counties that are experiencing extreme growth, where you got Minnehaha County, Lincoln County, Custer, Lawrence, and Pennington County. And so it would really kind of affect their budgets in a lot of ways. And so it would kind of affect funding formulas and really hamper, like as counties are facing increased costs, if they're facing 7% inflation, say, but they're only able to grow their budgets by about 2%, then, and I'm really bringing this down to like a lot, I'm not an expert here, but they will face increased costs, but only be able to raise so much.
Yeah.
And that would affect their budget.
So the whole goal, as I understand it, is really to target these people who have been living in their houses and in their property, you know, elderly people, people who've been in their homes for a long time, and all of a sudden they're being taxed out of their houses. Do any of these proposals seem like they will address that problem?
The governor's bill does address that problem. It's like the last section of that bill. It does like a number of things, but it does set certain income requirements and property value levels where you can reach out for a property tax freeze.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what about the sales tax and the sunset? Where is that discussed at all?
I have not heard that got brought up at all.
Okay. So it's all part of whatever is in these packages, that's how it's addressed or not. And the new leadership, Tony Van Huysen in the Lieutenant Governor's office, he would be the one who's probably working most closely on some of those legislative conversations.
You can imagine. I mean,
speculation.
Governor Roden has also been very involved. He's dealt with property taxes in the past.
Sure.
You kind of see him bringing people in and out of the second floor and walking around on the third floor and talking to people as well. So I think he's also very involved in that conversation.
Right. What else are you looking for before the session ends here on this home stretch?
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously prisons were a very big conversation, and that has sort of been reset, if you will. So lawmakers and a working group established by the governor is going to meet 4 times from April to July in anticipation of having a special session to vote on another a different prison idea conversation, how to deal with the men's prison there. So the 1,500-bed men's prison facility idea, as we have known it, I would say is off the table. There are also a couple, there's one particular eminent domain ban for liquid carbon pipelines bill that is out there currently. As we're taping right now, we don't know exactly what's going to particularly happen with that, but there are some ideas that are out there. There's kind of like a backup bill to do the same thing pending in the House, which is what it's already passed out of already. So that conversation is still kind of up in the air as to what that will look like as well.
Any updates on SDPB funding?
Yeah. I know I said last week that they were going to be doing motion sheets this week on SDPB funding. That is, I've currently not seen any particular or heard about any schedule for that to happen yet, but that's how the last couple weeks of session work. So you kind of know when you know when it comes up. So that's still out there and pending.
SDPB's Lee Sturbinger, thanks so much for the update.
Thanks, Lori.
I am joined now by SDPB's CJ Keene. CJ Keene, thanks for stopping by.
Happy to be here, Lori.
Give me an update on some of the stories that you have been covering. Monday night, you had a late night on the State Affairs Committee in Pierre. What's happening now?
Absolutely. House State Affairs, or Senate State Affairs, excuse me, has been swamped with bills right now. And it's really getting to crunch time for them. So they're doing double duty with their calendars these days. A lot of pipeline bills, a lot of voting rights bills. And the one that I've really been following closely is House Bill 1259. That would be South Dakota's latest attempt to establish a bathroom bill for all publicly owned buildings.
All right, bathroom restrictions or requiring people to use certain bathrooms has been an issue in the state before. Give us a little history about the political conversation around who can use which bathroom.
So, yeah, this has absolutely been a long-term conversation across South Dakota and really the country, maybe for up to a decade. And it's important to remember, this isn't the first time South Dakota lawmakers have danced with this kind of legislation, in that in 2016, I believe it was, then Governor Dennis Dugard, had this bill on his desk, or a similar bill on his desk, and he ultimately vetoed it. But here we are once again having a very similar conversation.
Yeah, famously he vetoed it after sitting in conversation with some transgender high school students who convinced him that the bill was harmful to them. Are you seeing people come forward and express to lawmakers the implications of this kind of legislation, or the hallways filled with lobbyists, essentially?
Well, right now, I think a lot of the transgender and LGBT plus community, they're advocating a lot on the streets. There were protests in Rapid City and Sioux Falls, very strong words against this bill. However, when you're sitting in committee, it's not the LGBT plus community who is speaking with lawmakers. It is a lot of Christian organizations. It's a lot of more conservative organizations.
And proponents of the bill are showing up more than the opponents. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Okay. And what are some of the arguments that they're giving?
So one of the big things is this is genuinely a bill about privacy and protecting people in private spaces. On the other end of that coin are people who are saying that this is transphobic, and that they're saying that this could open us up to costly legal battles. I spoke with Representative Brandi Schaefbauer last night, and she says that she believes that this is an earnest effort to protect people in vulnerable situations. But it's very important to remember a lot of crimes that would be committed in bathrooms are still crimes in bathrooms. Stalking, harassment, these are still crimes no matter where you are. So it's an interesting balance that is being walked here.
Do we have a sense with this governor, Governor Larry Roden, has he weighed in on or signaled at all that he would veto something coming forward, or that he would be open to a conversation about vetoing something that legislators pass?
I certainly cannot say for sure one way or the other. One of the big themes at the protest that I attended in Rapid City was there's a precedent set by then-Governor Dennis Dugard, and if Governor Roden is listening, definitely include the voices of people who would be most affected by this bill.
All right, what else are you following?
Another bill that was very interesting and just passed out of the Senate is Senate Bill 148. That is a bill to establish new code and definitions for things like AI and deep fakes, and in particular how it could affect elections.
All right, this is Senator Liz Larson. Prime sponsor bill?
Yes, this is a Liz Larson bill.
Yeah.
Really, she seems very firmly in the camp of we need to get ahead of the AI and deepfake curve. And you can't really blame her considering that we're already seeing very real implications with, you know, things like what we saw in New Hampshire with robocalls that really weren't even clear who they were supporting or opposing, but they're still teetering on that cusp of legality and election interference that's really troubling, especially to outside watchers.
What kind of support does the legislation have, and what are the opponents saying?
It was very widely supported, actually. Very few opponents say that the main issue here is a First Amendment constitutional issue. In her defense, Larson says this bill has a very explicit loophole, if you will, for satire and parody. So constitutionality wasn't as much of a concern of hers as it was for the handful of opponents on the Senate floor.
All right. We look forward to hearing more about that. CJ Keene, thank you so much.
Happy to be here, Lori.
We are joined now by South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley. Attorney General Jackley, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
It's a busy time of year.
It is busy between legislature and court cases. We have a lot going on at the Attorney General's office.
All right, let's talk about the legislature first, because you spoke with us at the beginning of the session about some of your goals and a very successful year for your legislative bills. Tell us a little bit about where you're at right now with them.
It's been a good year for public safety this legislative session. On the, you know, the protecting the public side, human trafficking has gone well, along with our corrections bill. We also brought four bills for government accountability. They've worked their way through. I think overall the legislature is bringing good prevention efforts, both with the government internal control board on the executive side, work to allow the elected state auditor to have access to records. And then there's some enforcement provisions for the Attorney General, including whistleblower. We've had some challenges whether that should be a misdemeanor or a felony. The Senate side has agreed to a felony. The House side is at a misdemeanor. That means it will likely go to a conference committee. I feel strongly that there needs to be good enforcement, that we've had too many cases in South Dakota of losing taxpayer dollars, and I feel strongly that this is the solution to avoid at least some of that.
So why make it a felony in the first place? Was there a specific reason, or is it a more broad reason that you think this is what it deserves?
There's a couple reasons. Actually, right now, it already is a misdemeanor. In fact, in one of the Department of Revenue cases, I've charged it out as a misdemeanor. So it is not having any deterrent effect. This stuff is still going on. So I feel it should also be elevated because of what we've seen in South Dakota, because of the importance of trusting and protecting taxpayer dollars. And from the employees in the state that I've talked to, most of them are law-abiding. They want to see enforcement provisions to bring back integrity. They support that felony provision.
So the idea is that a supervisor knows something's happening and does nothing to report it. Has that happened in the state?
It has several times. In fact, we had a representative come forth and talk about a situation when a state employee went to not one, but two supervisors and it was ignored, then went to a state representative who went to not just one, but two secretaries and was ignored, and finally came to the Attorney General, and I indicted the case within 5 months.
All right, so the criticism, of course, is do we need more felonies? We're building a new prison. There's not a lot of appetite from some people in the House to create a felony. What would your response be to them if you could talk to them directly?
My response is, and I would say they always let me talk to them directly. I love the legislative process because they always let me have a say, but they get to make the final decision. What I would say is EB-5, gear up, 6 criminal charges, 3 ongoing investigations. It's time to take this seriously. It's time to bring trust back to peer, and it's time to give those employees that are doing the right thing some protections.
Let's talk a little bit about a crime, a new crime report. Tell people about what the crime report is for. Is it for us to see? Is it for you to look at the data? How is a crime report used?
It's really for both. It's for me in law enforcement, it tells us where we need to generate efforts and resources. For the public, I think it tells the public generally, you know, safety issues, things to be aware of, things to be careful with children. Overall, what that report shows is a very slight increase in overall crime. We remain a very safe state. The things that trouble me as Attorney General are the homicides. Obviously, one homicide is too many, but 31, that's a big uptick. And so Sioux Falls has had more homicides than it's used to, and we need to make sure we're staying on top of it. A lot of these homicides come from probation, parole, and drugs. So if you control those, you will likely reduce the number of homicides. Some of them are domestic related, and that creates some additional challenges where maybe you don't have as good of prevention efforts, but it can start with some of the lower level domestic violence, taking that serious, making sure if there's a need for anger management or other opportunities, that those are employed at the trial level. But also, I would say, in addition to the homicides, we continue to have a substance abuse issue in South Dakota, like we do across the nation, and that's methamphetamine and fentanyl.
Are there actions that need to be taken as you look at the data, resources that need to be reallocated, training that needs to happen, more public prevention programs, for example?
The strongest ability to get at this would be to shut down the southern border. While Washington continues to talk about it, it still hasn't happened yet fully. The other thing that needs to happen in this state is prevention, treatment, and then prosecution of the drug dealers. The prevention efforts, they're out there. There are some monies that have come from the settlements that I, as Attorney General, brought on the opioid companies. Those dollars need to get put to use. On the treatment side, really until that prison conversation happens, we're not seeing major steps in that direction, but I'm hopeful that will happen. And then, of course, on the drug dealers, the legislature's looking at even some additional penalties for those that are, you know, dealing with fentanyl. And so there's some positive things going into effect. I would say on the prevention side also, there are a lot of nonprofit and faith-based organizations that help us with that. I use Emily's Hope is one of those examples. I've been working with them to get more naloxone or Narcan, which is that reversal agent, out into the communities so that if there is an overdose, we have an opportunity to save a life.
You and I have talked about prevention for quite some time, and you have said again and again consistently that prevention works, prevention campaigns work. Most of us remember the failed campaign from Governor Kristi Noem. Meth were on it. People didn't like that campaign. Money was spent. Do we need another public awareness campaign that you're aware of? Like, how do you look at that now? Because they can go wrong in the public eye.
Absolutely, we need another campaign. When I was Attorney General last time, although I couldn't get public funding for it, No Meth Ever, I think, has a catchier phrase. It was in our schools with Project Stand Up. I think a partnership between the schools and law enforcement makes sense, but we have to find that funding source. I believe that those cases that I brought for the opioid companies, because of what they've done and misrepresentations they've made, those dollars need to not be put in a trust fund somewhere. They need to be put to use. And I would encourage, when the next settlement comes, I'll be talking to the legislature about putting those dollars to use on an appropriate campaign. If they want the Attorney General to do it, I'm willing. If they want the governor to do it, I'm supportive of that.
In the crime report, we did lose an officer in the line of duty this year. Tell me where that case is at and what unfolded. There were it was a pursuit, and there were some strips to put down. Is that common practice? Help us understand that story and what happens next with prosecution.
So a year ago, last February, Officer Prorock was in the process of putting out spikes to stop a pursuit. That's a common practice. We do that to protect citizens so that we stop what is occurring. And unfortunately, the state's position is Hook, the defendant, swerved intentionally and killed the officer. I was just in court last week. We were set for trial May 19th. The defense filed a motion for continuance. The court granted that. October 14th is a new trial date. As Attorney General, I'm going to stick firm to that date. I think a year and a half is enough time. This case needs to be resolved by a jury. We have noticed the intent to seek the death penalty, so that is a capital case. The only other capital case we have in South Dakota right now, individual on death row, is Piper. I was actually just in federal court last Friday. We argued the last part of the state's motion to dismiss. If we are successful in that, we are in the final stages of that case.
Right. I want to talk about something else that's new here, and that is releasing your expense vouchers to the public. You don't have a state-issued credit card. You have expense vouchers. First, tell us, do you need, want a state-issued credit card?
I think after some of the recent publicity, I would never want a state-issued credit card. I've never asked for one. Mm-hmm. I've never felt the need for it. I mean, this is my fourth term as Attorney General. There just aren't those kind of expenses. If you look at my vouchers, they're typically case related. I got to travel to a court proceeding in Madison. I have to stay overnight for something like I had to in the Piper hearings. So I've received a discovery request for all of my records from Washington, D.C., and I didn't have any problem giving those, and I just felt might as well just give them to all the public given the conversation. So since I took office this last time up and through the records request, which was sometime in January 2025, I had about $7,200 of cheap hotel rooms, gas, and a few meals.
Burger King.
I ate at Burger King.
The Whopper, is that you, or is it the cheeseburger? So about, if you average that out, it averages to under $2,500 a year. When we look at the governor's expenses, it's not apples to apples, of course, but we're looking at like $130,000 a year, if I'm doing the math correctly. Help us understand how we should think about the discrepancy between what an attorney general spends and what a governor spends.
You know, I'm only going to comment regarding the Attorney General. And I think when you look at the Attorney General, the travel you should see is courtroom-related activity. That would be driving to proceedings. If I have to spend the night, if I'm in trial for a week, I need to have a hotel room, maybe some speaking engagements. I do actively participate in some training. I've been fortunate to be vice chairman and chairman of our Attorney General organizations, but for that travel, they'll pay for it. Unfortunately, the only time they don't is when it's in-state, and so when we had all the AGs out in South Dakota, they didn't pay for Deadwood. But again, those are pretty minimal charges. And so I would expect an Attorney General should have some charges. I feel that averaging around $2,500 a year is probably where things will be for the rest of my time as Attorney General. It's just that's a function of court proceedings spread out across the state.
Anything else this legislative session or anything else you want to mention to the public this week that they should be paying attention to?
Well, the things they should be paying attention to, I mean, the hot items and I think the ones that affect their livelihood will be, you know, number one, what is the legislature going to do with property taxes? Mm-hmm. Number two, what is going to happen ultimately with potentially a special session on the new prison and what is going to be occurring between now and when that first meeting is for a new prison. Government accountability. I mean, taxpayers spend a lot of money. They entrust state government and peer with a lot of money. What is the legislature going to do to protect those dollars?
Do you think it's a culture shift in state government, or is it simply there needed to be some guardrails in place that were never there, and the people who are going to try to commit those crimes got past those guardrails? Or is it an overall culture change for state workers that you're hoping for?
The ones that testified against government accountability used the culture concept. I just don't feel it's a culture. I mean, I feel we have 14,071 state employees. The vast majority of them are law-abiding. A few aren't. I feel we needed guardrails. I spent all day yesterday listening to an accountant in the Lana Carroll case talk about those guardrails, what the state should have done. And of course, I feel that the state, with some of the Attorney General's bills, are putting those guardrails in place on internal controls, on giving the people's auditor access to the records, and frankly, giving the Attorney General a heavier hammer when people don't follow those guardrails.
Yeah. Attorney General Jackley, thank you so much for sitting down with us.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to In the Moment State House. I'm your host, Lori Walsh, seated here in SDN Communications Studio in the State Capitol Building with Dakota Scouts, Jonathan Ellis, our Dakota Political Junkies analyst for today. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
It's a pretty exciting time. Things are kind of winding down, but yet there's a lot of work left to be done here in Pierre. What's the tone right now, would you say?
That there are some longer meetings going on, and after sometimes, you know, you're having afternoon meetings when typically after floor sessions that especially the State Affairs Committee is having to meet, the appropriators are meeting, they're kind of like trying to put the final pieces on the budget, things of that nature. So this is pretty typical. But there are still some big issues out there that are gonna be resolved near the end.
What are you waiting for?
Well, you know, I'm looking at there are some voting rights kind of, you know, restrictions on voting in some senses. And when I say restrictions, like residency rules,
sure.
There's been concern about out-of-state residents perhaps affecting balloting here in the state. So there's some talk about that. There's also going to be a push to, you know, more ballot issues that the legislature is going to put on the ballot for 2026. So there'll be a lot to talk about. In the next week and a half.
More ballot issues to come?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, not only from the legislature, but from activists who are going to be collecting signatures.
Yeah.
Hey, we're a direct democracy state in some sense.
So, we are looking at a budget, tough budget year as well, too. How's that sorting itself out? Does the prison, sort of the reset on the prison conversation with the summer study, does that change the state budget process measurably?
I don't think it does, okay. No. I mean, that money is going to be held in abeyance anyway. It's not like it can be used now in the regular budget. So I don't think that changes the picture. I mean, that doesn't change the picture of like ongoing revenues and things of that nature.
Yeah.
So, it is going to be a leaner budget year for sure. And I think they're preparing for that. And you always kind of want to wait to get the fullest picture you can before you create the budget. And so, And sometimes there have been instances where they haven't actually passed the budget until they come back on veto day to do it. And that's pretty rare, but they typically wait till the end so they can get the most current forecast they can get.
Yeah.
How it's going to look in the future.
And they have to balance. They're required to balance the budget.
They are. So every time they go, I balance the budget. Well, thanks for following the Constitution. You're required to do that. So yeah.
Any thoughts on Governor Roden and how his leadership has changed or not changed this session? Because we did have a change during this session, which is again incredibly rare.
Well, he's more present. Has been more present, and maybe that's because he hasn't had to go anywhere really. In this. I think he did go to the National Governors Association or something. He did one, but he's been more present. I think more of a presence in the Capitol. In my line, I'm speaking a little bit from the gut here, but yeah, it seems like he's more of a person persona here that is. He's wielding some influence, I think. Yeah.
So of course we're comparing him to our most recent governor, Kristi Noem, and you at the Dakota Scout have had quite a story these past few weeks about her credit card and the expenses on her state credit card. Tell us a little bit of that story, because it's been going on for how long for you, where you were trying to get access to those charges to look at them.
Yeah, so our reporter Austin Gosson originally put in an open records request with the state auditor's office back in May last year, and there was some back and forth on that. We kind of upgraded that in June, and then they ended up releasing what were monthly totals at the time through April of 2024. But we weren't satisfied with that. We thought the actual records themselves, they're public records, that they should be made public. And so we filed a lawsuit against the auditor's office, the state, back in September, seeking to get those records. And we litigated that. When Governor Noem left office, the state decided to settle that lawsuit with our lawyer, John Arneson, who actually deserves the credit on this, a longtime First Amendment lawyer for the media in the state, has won many victories for the First Amendment. And, you know, so we settled that, we got the records, and then it's been there are a lot of them. And we partnered with Sioux Falls Live, Patrick Lally, there to like help get them into a searchable format, and it was a huge lift. We've been working on that for a couple weeks now.
What were some of the reasons that originally you were given to not release those records?
They said originally that it would be a security threat. So for example, if you would see maybe patterns of her travel,
sure.
Which is ludicrous. I mean, okay, so I will say, teaser alert, she did like to go to the Venetian in Las Vegas, but you know, you don't know if you're gonna, you know, when she's gonna be there, those kinds of things. So that was their rationale, but it was just a cover to hide the documents, let's be honest. I mean, in public and financial documents are explicitly public records in South Dakota's, what I would say is very weak open records law.
Yeah, all right, so let's talk about some of the things that you found. What are some of your first impressions about Governor Kristi Noem's spending over the past 5 years?
Well, and I want to compare this to Governor Dugard's, because his were part of the request as well.
Okay.
And they only had 1 year left of his the retention schedule. And they're very different. They're very different. You know, there's a anecdote about Governor Dugard who he went out to lunch with one of his young staffers, I think maybe even an intern here, maybe in town at Dairy Queen or something like that. And he kind of bashfully, they ordered him kind of bashfully, oh, all I've got is a state credit card, can you pay? And so he didn't use it, he used it very sparingly. I mean, don't get me wrong, he used it. Mm-hmm. But he was pretty selective in when he used it. The Governor Noem, not so much. I mean, granted, a lot of these expenses, that she liked to go to Starbucks, she liked to go to Culver's. Now, these were when she was traveling. And mm-hmm. state employees are legitimately entitled to per diems. And so, I'm nothing against that. She was entitled to that as part of her as a state employee. But she did travel quite a bit out of state, and that really kind of intensified, I would say, after the summer of 2020. I mean, that was, and if you obviously putting that timeline together, that's when she really kind of had some, you know, national acclaim for her handling of how she handled the COVID crisis. And she really became, I think, as we would call, much more on the speaking circuit for conservative organizations, much more sought after person, and she kind of was rising to stardom. You know, so I that was part, you know, we paid in some sense as taxpayers. And a lot of these, a lot of the totals out of this were not necessarily even her, but for security.
For security.
Yeah.
What did we learn about the security that she had to take? So that's her security detail?
A security detail that that, that the state would, that would, you know, apply to her trips and things like that. So,
yeah. And what are you finding patterns in there? Like, what are your intentions next? With, you know, you've got a searchable database and for subscribers on Sioux Falls Live and Dakota Scout. What are you doing as reporters? To, you know, what are you interested in? When you look at all the information, what are the places that you want to, you know, dig in and say, well, what does this mean? What's the relevance of this?
I think, I mean, I think that it would be nice to be able to go back and say, okay, this hotel visit in Florida was really related to what trip?
Sure.
Was it to meet with Donald Trump? Was it because of CPAC or something? I mean, you know, so if you could go back, and that it's a very painstaking process to go back, what group was she speaking to? And I want to be very clear, there were also very legitimate, I mean, she went to the National Governors Association, Department of Education meeting in Phoenix. You know, there were she was doing rating agencies meetings in New York, which Governor Dugard did as well. So I mean, I'm not trying to say that there were, you know, that she did legitimate. And I would say maybe all, you could argue maybe all of it's legitimate, but certainly in her role as governor for the state of South Dakota, she was doing those trips. She was also doing trips related to her the fact that she was kind of a superstar in the conservative movement.
Yeah. So who is supposed to pay for those things? When does it have to come out of her campaign budget if she's campaigning? And when does it come out of, like, the governor has been called to, you know, CPAC to speak, and then we pay for that? What do we know the ground rules are here?
Well, and
are we rethinking what the ground rules are?
I don't know that there's a bright line there.
Yeah.
No. I think that those are some... those are judgment calls in some sense.
Yeah. So what questions do you...
I mean, she's representing, even if it is a state at CPAC or some organization like that, she is, in a sense, representing the state. So
then is it no big deal?
Why have them
out there?
I think transparency is important. I think that taxpayers always need to be aware of, like, how their money is being spent and have those questions.
Yeah. Netflix charges.
Yep.
Why is that?
She had a Netflix account. Again, you can argue that there's probably, you know, maybe some legitimacy out of that. She had a SiriusXM account, and she rationalized that as needing to be stay up on current events. Which, okay, Governor Dugard's office had a subscription to the Argus Leader, for example. I mean, which was even more expensive, I'm sad to say, about my former employer than the SiriusXM account. So there are those kinds of, like, areas. I was interested to meet that Governor Dugard had a $15 a month charge that on his card for a at-home security system for his place in Garrettson, which, again, I think that's a legitimate expense. I think the taxpayers, you know, probably should pay for the governor's security system. You know, so those are just kind of the lines you have to, like, those are judgment calls. But at the end of the day, those records should just be out in the public, and then we get to make those decisions. We get to question that.
DakotaScout.com is where you can find your work. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Yep, thank you.
Welcome to In the Moment State House. I'm Lori Walsh, and I'm seated in the SDPB SDN Communications Studio inside the Capitol Building and Pier. Joining me, Representative Will Mortensen. Representative Mortensen, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a real treat for me.
We're at the finish line of the legislative session. It's been quite a session. Tell me a little bit about some of the highlights, things that you feel like we accomplished something here, and then we'll talk about some of your frustrations.
Yeah, well, each year you come in, and I always view the legislature's goal primarily as keeping the state on track. This year I really redoubled myself to the Hippocratic Oath of first do no harm. And so this year's been largely about that. But, you know, I've always viewed that as kind of a common sense and conservative ethic in South Dakota that's been pervasive for a long time, that we trust our cities to run the cities, we trust our grain elevators to run the grain elevators, our school boards to run the schools. And so for my part this year, I think some of the best things we've been doing is trying to keep some of the regulations off of those folks. It's a tough budget year, and so a lot of cases when you point to the very clear, you know, here's something we provided that we didn't have before or something good that we did. Mm-hmm. Those are tied to money. And this year, it's a tight budget year. And so there's a lot less to talk about. But we'll finish with a balanced budget, and I think we'll do our best not to get in the way of the good things that people are doing across the state.
You mentioned trust, and you wrote a column about where some of your fellow lawmakers are really getting their information, and it's not necessarily from their local librarian or their local school administrator. They're looking at the internet, and they're finding some things that's changing some of the dialogue. Tell me a little bit about what you've noticed and how that's impacting the debate in Pierre.
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, I've always just, I ran for this because I have a fundamental faith in the people of South Dakota. Again, when I think about who knows the most about running a hospital, I trust that hospital board and those administrators, and who's best at running an ag outfit. I talk to those folks, and so, but that's just a fundamental belief in South Dakotans that are working in there very often, and I would say even increasingly so. All politics are national, and so a lot of these spur from really national issues that get incited and kind of filter through, in a lot of cases, the internet, for sure. I mean, there's no doubt that the internet is having a harmful effect on social trust broadly, and, you know, we haven't even really realized the full impacts of AI on that yet, but I think that anybody who spends any time in a Rotary Club or in a coffee group or anything knows that a lot of the social ties that bind are weakening a little bit, and it's sure hurting the way we're doing our business in the legislature, because again, we don't have the trust in the people of South Dakota and the institutions in South Dakota that have made our state, I think, so productive and so strong and such a real community for a long time.
You can't sequester, right?
No, right.
So are there ways, is that leadership then, where you, because it impacts what you get done, but it also impacts how much you get done.
Well, that's true.
And your focus.
Yeah, it does. And it's, I would say it has a fair amount more to do. Well, one other factor I would point to is just a lot more turnover leads to this too. I mean, we had an issue on the floor yesterday that I've probably seen four or five times, and I've only been here for my fifth year. For a lot of folks who are seeing it with brand new eyes and without the historical context, and if you're not willing to get that from folks in your community who have boots on the ground, then we're kind of, you know, steering a ship with a blindfold on.
Yeah. What did you see specifically?
Yesterday we were dealing with a lot of things on internal controls and GOAC and some of these things, but they're not new issues, they're, you know, recurring, but you learn to flesh out the debate and find the arguments that really map onto your values, and if you're not willing to dig into them deeply, you might miss something even if your values would suggest otherwise.
Sure. Let's talk a little bit about the eminent domain and the pipeline, because last legislative session, that was something you and I spent a lot of time talking about. You worked really hard to listen and bring forward legislation that you thought was effective. It turned out to not be popular with the voting public, and it's being discussed again now. Some people didn't come back because they were primaried because of their vote on that issue. Mm-hmm. How is that debate unfolding this year, and what are your thoughts on it?
You know, mercifully, we had kind of one bill early in the House, and then it's been over in the Senate's court really since then. 2 years ago, I helped draft a bill that made clear that the statute authorizing eminent domain for something like this carbon pipeline, which is not really being used in a commodity context, doesn't have eminent domain. I mean, that's been my position from the beginning. And that was, of course, the hottest element of this whole thing. When I figured out a year ago that we couldn't make progress on that, I wanted to make sure that landowners were protected in other contexts. I would say that the effort we put forward last year to try to provide some of those protections was pretty intentionally misled as to what that bill did. And so it was defeated, and I think that some people got their political goals out of it. I don't think our state was benefited at all from rejecting that piece of legislation, but now we're back to it, and what I mostly am frustrated about this carbon pipeline is the impact it's having on our state in kicking up just a broad, not in my backyard sentiment. And it's moved from blocking that project to blocking other ag projects to blocking housing construction to blocking, you can't disconnect that from blocking the prison. that now it's just, you know, if anybody has any grievance, they think the government should step in and stop any construction they don't like. That's going to really hurt our state in the long run. I mean, that's how they do it in Europe. That's how they do it in California. And that's why they have stagnating, you know, economy in Europe, is they say government first. And if anybody has a complaint, government steps in. And I'm just worried about what that looks like for our next 50 years.
You said last year when we talked at the end of last session, I hope that we don't become a state where we don't build things. I hope we don't become that. And you had a real concern, and now you're maybe more concerned rather than less a year later?
Yeah. You have to be. I mean, this year's legislature has largely been more regulation on private businesses, more regulation on parents, more regulation on schools, more regulation on libraries. And that's not a good thing where I'm standing. You know, a week ago we were debating a bill to repeal the Future Fund. And I thought it was such perfect encapsulation that we're just not really focused on the future anymore. I mean, we're working to build what I think most people want, which is a place their kids want to come back and live. We're not building opportunities for young people. We're not working on how they can read better or how we can use AI to do individual learning outcomes. We're focused on how we can lock up librarians, how we can muzzle school boards, how we can block construction of economic development projects or prisons or whatever. And it, I think losing that focus is really gonna sow bad results in the future. I think from Governors Mikkelsen to Janklow to Rounds to Dugard, we've had a long history of very sensible conservative leadership, but always focused on our kids and on the future of this state and how we make it stronger and more prosperous. And now we're not talking about that at all. Now we're talking about, we don't like how this person made this decision, so we'll make it for them, whether we have all that information or not. And I mean, that's been the principal frustration. The good news is we've largely defeated the most pernicious proposals, but what a way to spend your winter, you know?
Yeah. What are you hearing from your constituents throughout the session?
Their eyes are pretty high in their heads. There's a lot of, what the heck are you guys doing up there? I do reassure them and just say, you know, we're going to wind up with a year where maybe we don't do a lot of things affirmatively, but we've mostly not done too much harm either. But this is a year, and there have been several of them in the last 10 years, where there's a big sense of what the heck are you guys doing up there?
Yeah. And some of that has to do with the budget. And not having, you know, you don't have to focus on where is all this money going to go, and we have to get it there fast because it's federal COVID money. But what do you want to see happen in the final days? Are there things that you want to get over the finish line?
Yeah, we've got, you know, we scratched and clawed to get some money for technical schools, which I think is a really key component for making sure that the kids who want to stay here and have a great career can. So one of those, you know, I think the biggest chunk of money that is undecided right now is the money that was going to go to the prison, and if we're going to set it aside for future prison construction, or are they going to, you know, spend it or put it into some sort of pet fund now? I think that'd be pretty irresponsible. Anybody who's looked at the price of steel or concrete or any of the inputs to a prison knows those are not going down. I mean, as much as we might wish and pray that this only cost $500 million, it doesn't and isn't going to. So I think we should set aside that money this year and be, you know, talking to my colleagues about why that's important. And I think we'll get there. I think Governor Roden has bought enough goodwill with his reset plan to convince a majority of the legislature to set that money aside.
And that's our show for today. We hope that it served you. As a reminder, the Dakota Political Junkies is a podcast. If you want to just listen to political coverage, you can find it on any podcasting platform. Look for SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. Our videographer is Jordan Henderson. Thanks to the SDPB team and peer for their production assistance. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.